Good evening, James McCanny here, going right into my show. I want to lead off with a little bit of a parable, maybe, something of that nature, and comparison. I'm going to do a little bit of what I call Economics 101 tonight, kind of common sense of economics, and we've all taken economics in some capacity. I took it in college. And it's almost comical to see the professor get up and spout theories, etc. But really, when it comes to real economics, the law of supply and demand and those type of theories really don't apply. And we're starting to see actually the breakdown of what we might call economics today. But at any rate, here's a story that I wanted to relate to you regarding the current economic meltdown, as it is called. And I just noticed today another $38 billion was given to this group and another $200 billion was given to that group. And then the line is forming as companies start to line up to get bailout money. In fact, I was joking with somebody this afternoon talking, and I said, I'm going to call my congressman and propose the JMcCannyScience.com bailout, right? How about $2 billion? That would be probably pretty good. Excuse me. I probably could do quite well on that. So, at any rate, here's the story I wanted to begin with. A lazy and thoughtless man failed to plant and plan for the future, so eventually this man was starving. So he cut off his right arm and ate it to solve his dilemma. After a few days, he realized this was only a short-term fix, so he ate his left arm and was jubilant as he proclaimed to all around that he had once again solved his hunger problem. After a few more days, he started to wonder about the rationale of eating his right foot, but he had no choice since he could no longer work or plant or harvest because he had eaten both of his arms. Eventually, the man died of starvation. So I think that's the state of our economy in a nutshell. Unfortunately, and I've been talking, I've talked before about, for example, 401k and other, for example, retirement accounts. The 401k was a bogus proposition right from the very beginning, because all that ever happened when people, the hardworking people, put their savings into a 401k, the only thing that happened with that money, it's not like there's a pool of money someplace in the bottom of these corporations where they've been saving your money. That money simply went laterally through the corporation and paid the dividends of the top 1 to 2% of shareholders. The 401k was never an investment. It was never meant to be an investment. It was meant to be a ripoff. So when the people started to try to take their money out, of course, the whole time they were putting money into the 401k, it went into the stock market and caused a great surge in the stock market because these people were not putting money in before, the average person. Stocks were typically for the wealthy. And so all of this money every week, 6%, 10%, 20% from working people added up. But if you calculate it out in any given corporation, it only equaled the amount of money that was paid out by that corporation to the top 1% or 2% of stockholders. But wait a minute, wasn't there a company matching funds that went along with this? Sometimes 50%, sometimes 100%. And the corporation supposedly matched the 401k investment of the worker. Well, that was a little bit of Reaganomics funny money too. Because what actually happened is at the end of every year, the corporation, by simply signing a form, thereby created the tax, created the stocks that were given to the employees in the name of money. And then this corporation got a cash write-off off of its taxes. For creating that phony wealth and then pretending to give it to the employees as a matching. But of course, since you could never take this out, as with any good Ponzi scheme, Now and then a few people would take their money out because of hardship or other reasons that were very limited. And so it looked like there was actually money there, when in fact that there never was any money in the 401k program. And as people then would go to pull their money out, of course, the stock market was never meant to be a savings account. It was meant to invest so that corporations could prosper and grow and do things that they normally wouldn't be able to do without investment capital. And so now you see the stock market is failing, and that's because there never was any value there. The numbers were simply fictitious. So at any rate, as with the man who ate his right arm and his left arm, as with the banking system that simply puts phony money into numbers on a ledger in a book that is held in a bank, the banks don't have any money. They may as well leave their bank doors, their secure vaults wide open, because there's no money in those banks. They're empty. So at any rate, that's why these systems are failing, and they'll continue to fail. But understand that these things have happened before. The whole idea of phony money and enslaving an entire nation in debt, these are old biblical occurrences. In fact, they were outlawed in the Bible. Excuse me. So the what's happened here, the Bush legacy, is one of enslaving the United States in so much debt that it will never, ever be able to pay it out. So all of the bailouts that are going on, the people who stole the money out of these corporations, they're gone, the money's gone, and now it's being replaced with loans being placed on the American public to the tune of so much money. This is on top of the war debt, which has not come in yet. On future wars, both the candidates are proposing new wars, ongoing wars, and so you find that simply the state of the United States and the rest of the world, which is following phony taxes, phony wars, phony money, a Treasury secretary who bows to a private bank, the Federal Reserve, which is an arm of the European banking community. And finally, and last but not least, this past week, the coup de grace, the final straw, the bailout that the final, the congressional vote was very necessary, because it gave carte blanche. Basically, Congress gave away, finally, the last straw, gave away its constitutional right to mandate the purse strings of this country. That's what Congress did this past week. So I want you to understand what happened. This is a historical event. That's why they ran it through on a weekend. That's why they had these scare tactics that you have to do this. That's why they went up and down the halls of Congress putting any kind of butter and sugar on that bill so every congressman would vote for it. And I'm sure there was a little coercing going on behind the scenes, but The final verdict is that Congress gave away its constitutionally mandated authority to man the purse strings of this country, and it gave it over to the private banks. So this country is no longer anything like the United States. It is history. And the only thing left now is for the people, the hardworking people, to become slaves to a monetary system. And that's exactly what happened. So I'm going to cut that short, but basically that's economics 101, what happened here. Of course, the Security Exchange Commission failed. The banks failed to be to oversee their lending. And, of course, this was all done on purpose. As I said, these things have happened before. And in ancient history, and we had laws that were written in the ancient books, including the Bible, telling of interest and how it should be mandated. All of those rules have been broken, and the end result. But I found it interesting tonight, just as I was listening to news just before this show started, that sheriffs around the country have stopped evicting foreclosed homeowners, renters, etc. And so basically what would happen is they would evict someone. The bank would send the sheriff out for an eviction, a foreclosure eviction. And what would those people do? They went right down to the county for welfare. And so it's become such a problem that the counties are telling the sheriffs, you can't do this anymore. So the kickback, the reflex reaction of the economic system is that people are no longer going to be thrown out of their homes for foreclosures. So the next step, obviously, is that people will simply stop paying their mortgages. Isn't that interesting? So and then stay in their homes and say, come and get me. And, of course, the sheriff will not do that because now he has orders that he is not to evict people from foreclosed homes. Isn't that an interesting little twist on how greed has its own economic kickback, so to speak? So at any rate, as I said, enough of that. But I wanted to talk about a couple other topics here. And then the one main question that most people want to know is, what should you do in this state of economic collapse of this country, of the world? Basically, you have to take care of yourselves. And that's something I've been saying all along. You need food. You need dry goods. You need a water filter so that you can be your own source of fresh water. And in many cases, you have to have enough supplies so you do not leave your house. You have to be able to stay there and under for long periods of time and basically take care of yourself. And the society is going to come to this. The people that have not prepared and the people who have to leave their homes for supplies or for water or for whatever are going to be the ones that get into trouble. And I've noticed this in the, just for example, my water filter sales, the Dalton water filters with the white ceramic filters, the sales have increased. And as long as I'm talking about that, once again, I'll just mention on this show, I stopped selling the black filters last May 22nd for many reasons. I would not recommend anyone buying those. And the at this point, unfortunately, and the white ceramic filters are available in pairs. They're $89 for a pair. As we found out in the Iowa flooding, the black filters would clog and fail, and therefore really are not what you need in case of an emergency. The white ceramic filters could be cleaned and recleaned under the most severe, basically pouring goop or mud water into the water filters directly, and those white ceramic filters could be cleaned and reused dozens and dozens of times. So that's why I sell those, that's why I recommend those, and I would recommend that anybody that has the ability to get a set of the white ceramic filters, the 7-inch filters that I sell for a real emergency when, for example, water would be very, very polluted or very muddy or whatever the situation. So I just want to mention also there were some questions that came in about 9 and 10-inch filter elements with the water filters. And I just wanted to clarify that there are many reasons why the 7-inch filter is what you want to use in your water filter. And these are, of course, ongoing things we're learning as we go through this these times and learn basically by field tests, etc. What happens with the 9 and 10-inch filter elements is they actually filter less water. They are much slower at filtering water, and here's why. When you have a water filter submerged in water, there's a physical principle called head pressure, and the water completely surrounding the filter provides pressure on all sides, including the top of the filter. So the filter works much faster with head pressure. That's the pressure that's because of water being up completely over the top of the water filter element. The 9 and the 10-inch water filter elements, the head, is as soon as you start using the water, as soon as the water starts going down, the head pressure is lost and they take a much longer to filter water. So that's why, once again, I sell the 7-inch ceramic water filters. It's a 3-part filter, not a 1-part filter. The carbon is inside in 2 layers of ceramics, which do the filtering, so it is a true filter, not an absorber. And so at any rate, I just wanted to clarify that. A number of people had written in and asked what the rationale for the 7-inch filter. So in the case of water filter elements, longer is not better. In fact, if we could make a 4-inch filter, we would do it. But there are just manufacturing limitations, and so the size that we've settled on. And by the way, for some time I sold the mini personal Dalton water filter, and those were very popular. And shortly we will have back, those will be back again. And I'm sorry it took so long, but getting anything done in this world we live in today is more and more difficult. So at any rate, I'll have an initial run of those, and I'll announce that. So get ready when you see those, when I announce it on this show, and they will be posted on the webpage. And they'll be available by mail order, of course. Get ready to order those if you are somewhat in the waiting line. And people that have been on hold waiting will be the first ones, of course, to get those. We'll have a limited number, a number of hundreds of units. And then after that, about 3 or 4 weeks later, we'll have a bigger shipment in, so that hopefully we won't run out again. It was just such a popular item, it surprised all of us how fast the stock went out, and then also how long it would take to get them restocked, just because they come from England. They don't come from the United States, and so it's a long process to get everything in order. So once again, I'll just briefly summarize. You need your own water filter. These are gravity water filters. No hoses, pumps, electrical connections, or anything. You just put the water filter element in, screw it in the top container, pour water in. It filters water through to the bottom. And I sell the Dalton brand, because I've learned a lot, and that is the brand that I find historically goes back to the 1800s. It was the original filter produced by the Daltons, and there's a lot. I have a history on my webpage if you have some time. I'm not going to repeat that on this show. On to the topic of the Stephen Fawcett accident. I'm not going to belabor this point, but basically, what I see happening is a whitewash of that accident. I don't see where anybody ever confirmed that that was the plane that Stephen Fawcett was piloting that day. What was it, September 3rd, or was it 7th of over a year ago? And there are many questions involving the discovery of that, because when the pictures of the wreckage finally came out, and it was scattered amongst this extremely rocky hillside up in the upper mountains and near Mammoth Lake, very, very rugged terrain, and no trace of the pilot was found. They claimed that there were some bone slivers found there, but no trace of shoes or other artifacts that would have been there even after a year. And the biggest question is, the whole story began when some guy found $100 bills, apparently about 10 of them, and some driver's license and a pilot's license with Fawcett's name on it down the mountainside. So if Fawcett died in the air crash and they're finding bone parts in the air crash area, how did this wallet and $100 bills get into a nice, neat little pile down the mountainside? So it's looking more and more like one of those bungled CIA setups, because back in the 1980s, the CIA formed a team of air accident helpers, I would call them, Let's look at a number of air crashes. John Denver, JFK Jr., the senator from Missouri, I forget his name offhand. And then let's look at some other accidents that have occurred, things like Sonny Bono. By the way, I usually don't make announcements like this on the show, but last Saturday, October 4th, Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast interviewed a guy, and I don't know this man, Bob Fletcher, I don't know him at all, but he portrayed a story regarding Sonny Bono's death and the circumstances around it, where they were about to investigate top NSA, CIA, military, and government officials in the early 1980s for drug-related issues and, of course, what we now call Iran-Contra. And the reason I mention that is because many people have seen those same scenarios, and I can tell you from personal experience, when I was out in California looking for funding for my science projects, that I saw the very same thing. It was rampant, it was openly talked about, and that was before the public release of information regarding Iran-Contra. But there's no question that people high up in the U.S. government, the CIA, the NSA, and the military were all involved in these activities. And so Sonny Bono was about to investigate this when he died of a so-called skiing accident. Stephen Fawcett, I want to add one last bit of information. As the whitewash news started to announce and write him off as dead in this crash, this, by the way, it's my belief at this point that the crash that they found was a setup and possibly put there a number of months ago, and that wasn't the plane at all that Fawcett was flying. That there was another accident, and possibly that was part of the wreckage that they had strewn over this area. But isn't it interesting, a couple simple facts, that the only piece of the airplane that wasn't totally destroyed was a section of the tail that had the aircraft number on it. And the other thing I noticed about the whitewash news, it's not what they say, it's what they don't say. For example, they came up with a story about Fawcett having a secret project with some guy that was an underwater submersible where they were supposed to dive down to a tremendous depth in the ocean and then come up and set a record in record time. But they never, never, never mentioned his real lifelong term goal of going into space and breaking records. And of course, he was associated with Richard Branson and Burt Rutan, and not to mention other people who have died in this effort, the engineers on Burt Rutan's engineering team who died in the explosion on a test bed last year. And I'll tell you from experience, the last thing that people high up in the world power groups, the last thing they want is somebody going into outer space in a private space program. John Denver, as I said many times, was about to become the first astronaut, private astronaut, to go into outer space just before he died in a Burt Rutan-designed airplane in San Diego Harbor. He was about to become the first astronaut with the Russian space program. So you find a pattern of John Denver, Sonny Bono, Stephen Fawcett, JFK Jr. The list goes on and on of people who were attempting to do some very innovative work and were squashed out before they could progress and accomplish those goals. So the biggies, what are the biggies? Going into space. They do not want people going into outer space or pursuing private space industry. The FAA has done nothing but put red flags and red tape between private enterprise and outer space. And the other issue is people coming out of the middle of the ranks, the populist ranks, in gaining popularity that don't belong to those banking cartel groups. Okay, enough of that. I'm going to go on to the main science topic, but the reason I wanted to go over all of this, the Economics 101, the Stephen Fawcett case, is because you can see a complete picture of people attempting to do good things, to work hard, and another group of people whose entire goal and aim is to destroy, to prevent, and to stay on top. That's how they stay in power, is by destroying the efforts. They steal and they destroy. That's what they are. That's what they do. And that's exactly what they've done to this economy, with techniques that are biblical in age-old techniques that were outlawed, now entering again to control this country and the world. And of course, they want control of the entire world. The only little problem is that many parts of the world, many countries have figured out this game and have broken off. And of course, those are the countries that you see being called terrorist or axis of evil in the mainstream press. Let me see if I have any other topics here. Just a few kind of quick fun facts about water. This comes from the freshwater.org, Freshwater Society. A person can live weeks without food, but only days without water. Here's something from water.org. A person needs 4 to 5 gallons of water per day to survive, but the average American individual uses 100 to 176 gallons of water at home each day. The average African family uses only 5 gallons of water per day. Every 15 seconds, a child dies from a water-related disease. Across the world, water-related diseases are the leading cause of death for children under the age of 5. At any given time, half the world's hospital beds are occupied by patients suffering from water-related disease. Nearly 97% of the world's water is salt water or otherwise undrinkable. Another 2% is held in ice caps and glaciers. That leaves about 1% for all of humanity's needs, including agriculture, residential, industrial, as fresh water. Here's one more little fun fact about water. Water serves several functions in the human body. It regulates the temperature of the human body, carries nutrients and oxygen to the cell, cushions joints, and protects organs and tissues. The human brain is 75% water, human blood is 83% water, and bones are 25% water. And so just one other issue with the economy, I pulled up this the year-long silver valuation, or what they call spot value. And it's very interesting that in the very beginning of August, when the manipulated storms began, when many other events occurred, when the economic international meltdown began, the price of silver that is being quoted on the internet started to plummet. And it has stayed down around a surprising $10 per ounce value over recent weeks. It's very interesting to see that if you went to buy silver, you, first of all, wouldn't be able to find any, or very rarely would you be able to find any. And second of all, the real value of silver, people are paying $25 an ounce and upwards on the real market. So it's interesting to see this artificially quoted price, and one wonders about things like the stock market, which is crashing daily. Someone told me the other day, if the stock market continues to go down at the rate it's going down over the past week, it will be at zero within 2 weeks. Not good. Not good if you put your faith or trust in the stock market. There is a couple of other quick scientific points I want to make. The European Union project for quantum cryptography made a claim that they have discovered an unbreakable encryption code. And I looked into this and I thought, okay, Because as I've said before, of course, my book Calculate Primes, and the release of that was the final straw breaking the RSA prime number encryption codes around the world, for security, for military, for banking, etc. Anybody who claims to have an unbreakable encryption scheme is rather comical, because every time you invent one, there's 10 ways to break it. It just takes a little time. So anyway, they claim to have a system of unbreakable encryption. This was just released actually hours ago in the news media. But let me say this. What they do is they send photons or light particles down a optical transmission medium like optical fiber, fiber optics, commonly called fiber optics, and they claim that any interception would be immediately detected. Well, I guess I got news for them. That's called a private network, and any private network is much more secure than something that's simply broadcast and transmitted. So part of the problem with public encryption is that the broadcast goes to many places where you are not in control of that broadcast. So their system, first of all, will break down under general use, because the way banking is done, the way transmission is done, they won't have access to all of the places where this information is being transmitted. In other words, it's not a private network. So anybody, in fact, you don't even need encryption if you have a private network. Why would you need encryption if you have a totally encapsulated private network? You would not. So at any rate, I have to chuckle at people who claim to have unbreakable encryption. There's never been an unbreakable encryption scenario, and there never will be. As I always say, he who lives by encryption will die by encryption. This past week, it was announced three physicists won the Nobel Prize this year. And once again, these are noteworthy discoveries. And this one was dealing with the discovery of the mechanism of spontaneous broken symmetry in subatomic physics. And so that might impress all of you, the concept of broken symmetry. But the problem is that for 99.9999999% of the general public in the world, they don't know about this, they don't care about it, and it's not something, as I've said before, that the Nobel Prize should have other considerations besides the small group of esoteric 300 experts who give advice to the Nobel Committee. One of the considerations, in fact, one of the major considerations, should be the influence that this has on the public, the notoriety that it'll carry with the public. So most people forgot about this year's Nobel Prize as soon as they heard about it. On to the science topics for the night. I said that I would be talking about, I posted this on my webpage, I said, what is something that affects all of us every day, and in fact, something like weather, but not weather, something like temperature, that would be another one, or the amount of humidity in the air. These would all be things that affect us every day, but in fact, this is not what I want to talk about tonight. The topic I want to talk about is fluoridated water. The idea that there's something being put in water that people drink, and why does this affect everybody? Because more and more and more, I'm seeing people walking around, driving around, stumbling around in a complete stupor. And many people have said recently, I hear this all the time, how can people be so stupid these days? How come the American public is walking around like they're in a stupor? Well, the answer is they are. And that's one of the issues with the entire concept of fluoride in water was developed in World War II Germany. The entire issue was to give a substance that could be easily distributed to the masses and that would cause them to be controllable. And that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing people simply walking around, driving around, and I think it's most noticeable when you're driving, because people are simply not there. You drive down, you drive by them, you look in the window of their automobile, and their jaw is hanging down, they're staring at the road, and you know that there's absolutely nothing going on inside that head. So a fluoride stupor is what I call it, and a good part of the American public is subject to this. It affects us all because these are counted in the vote. When you vote for, say, public office, they are clogging up our highways. They're clogging up our just about everything else. And pretty soon, we are going to be forced to recognize this as a national problem. There are many people that we've often talked about requiring people to have driving tests. And that after a certain age, or if a number of people would call in about the same person, literally complain, call in their license number and say, this person really should not be on the road, get him off the road and have him or her tested for driving capability, that it would probably overwhelm the system, and that's probably why they wouldn't consider such an idea. So at any rate, what is something that affects all of us every day? People walking around in a fluoride stupor, driving around, driving an automobile that and causing accidents, whatever they're doing, completely unaware of the world around them. Just a quick note on NASA. NASA reached its 50th anniversary last week, and for our $1 trillion and 50 years, I don't have to go into detail about what we have. I could go into a lot of detail about what we do not have, but to imagine that this is going to go on for the next 25 years as a government-supported major agency and program is almost hard to imagine. Just the rumblings from within the space agency itself, of course, they're trying to redesign or rebuild the old Apollo space program. It's a total failure. They have a $3 billion a year budget out of the NASA budget, and it is an absolute failure. The people working on the program only go there for a paycheck and say they're actually forming other groups to design another type of system, another type of rocket system. But as I said before, rockets will not get us into space. They're not the method of transportation or propulsion that we should be using, because electromagnetic propulsion systems are on the board, they're on the table. I have two designs of my own, and just like driving around in fossil fuel automobiles based on gasoline and oil consumption, it's not the way of the future. So we are now locked into the next 25 years with NASA, and my guess is that if you made this announcement in 25 years, you would find that very little, if anything, has been accomplished. A few great things have happened by people who've somewhat gone out on their own within that agency, if that's possible. But for the amount of money, the amount of manpower, the amount of time, and as a national entity, probably the most important entity in our country, it is an absolute and disgusting failure. That's the best thing I can say about NASA. Understanding gravity waves. This is the main science topic for tonight. And I want to concentrate on this. I've given shows before where I talk about action at a distance, how a passing large cometary body would affect Earth, and I've given some generalities. But every now and then I'm going to pick apart one of the small incidental aspects of a large passing cometary body and talk about it, and so tonight I'm going to concentrate on gravity. and that is not the only effect. Many times people think of electricity or electrical discharges between the planets, and those do occur. There are plasma effects. But gravity is one of the major effects that would cause serious problems if we did in fact have an object come by Earth or through the solar system. I've talked about action at a distance where a comet would interact with the sun electrically, causing large-scale solar flaring, and that could affect us, it could affect our weather, etc. But just now, let's imagine, to do this, I have to instruct you on how to imagine a gravitational field. And it's something, as a physicist, you understand, you learn about this, you learn about the properties of gravitational fields, and they follow a certain formula. And so without trying to go into equations and numbers and theoretical concepts, I'm going to try to get you to understand exactly how gravity works at close range between two large-scale objects. Now, let's imagine, just for example, let's say that the nucleus of the comet that was coming by, and of course it's shrouded in a huge comet tail that's being drawn in by electrical forces. That's you can learn more about that, of course, in my books. But let's imagine, just as an example, that Earth is encountering an object in outer space that is exactly the same size, mass, density as Earth. Then we'll go to smaller, then we'll go to larger, and just see how this object would affect Earth. First of all, there's a concept called surface gravity. If you stood on the surface of this object, if you took away the vast comet tail, if you took away the electrical discharging, the chemical formation that's going on around the comet, and you stood on the nucleus of that comet, and you put a scale there, because it is the same density, it's the same diameter, it has all the same physical properties of Earth, and by the way, these are hypothetical examples. I want to make that clear, just for illustration. Because we know in the past, objects have come by Earth, probably some of them much larger than Earth, some of them smaller. But this, just as a hypothetical example, and to give you some understanding of how planetary gravitational fields work. Imagine this object being exactly the same dimension, density, etc. of the planet Earth. So if you could stand on the surface of this object with a scale, you would weigh exactly the same amount as you weigh on Earth. The surface gravity is the same as Earth's. Now, if you go out away from that planetary surface, the farther you go away, the less you would weigh. Your weight would decrease because you're getting farther away from the center of gravity, the center of the mass that makes up this body. And in the same exact way as Earth, if you went away from Earth, if you could stand out in outer space, just stand still, not in orbit, then stand on a scale, you would weigh less the farther up you go, the farther from the center of the Earth. And of course, there are equations that govern this. Now imagine, for the sake of argument, that this object is bigger. Let's say twice the diameter as Earth. It's bigger, it's the same density, let's say, for example. Now, would you imagine, some people might think, well then, if you stood on the surface of that object, you would weigh twice as much. And the actual answer is that that is not correct. You would actually weigh less than twice as much because you're farther away from the center of that planetary or comet nucleus. That I call them planets also because they're planets in formation. If you could take an object exactly the same size as Earth and double its mass, you would weigh twice as much. So there are, as I said, there are relationships, and the physicist would understand these in terms of mathematical equations. But I'm just trying to get you to understand the idea that just because an object is bigger doesn't mean that it has a proportionate surface gravity related to it. But now imagine that these two objects, and we'll go back to the example where the objects are exactly the same size as Earth, and you bring one together very close to Earth. Let's pretend for this example that that object does not have an atmosphere at all, even though a comet, of course, has a gigantic atmosphere. Let's imagine that, say, an object something like our moon, but the same exact size as Earth, the same density, the same dimensions as Earth, and it has no atmosphere at all. And you bring that object in, kind of with a great big cosmic hand, and you move it towards Earth. Eventually, when it gets close enough, it's going to grab on to the atmosphere of Earth, and it's going to distribute it around the second incoming planetary object. And let's pretend that these are not colliding, they're just kind of moving close together, moving closer and closer. Your magic cosmic hand moves that planet in towards Earth. So they get close enough to where this object eventually just pulls half of the atmosphere off of Earth, and this atmosphere then distributes itself equally over this same exact sized object. The object is exactly the same size as Earth. So our atmosphere would distribute itself equally over these two planetary surfaces, because their surface gravity is exactly the same. Now let's take a smaller object that has a lower surface gravity than Earth has, and we want to bring that in just with your magic cosmic hand. You're going to take that planet, and if you stood on the surface of this smaller object, let's say something like our moon, you would have, in the example of our moon, you would have 1/6 the weight, you would weigh 1/6 as much as you do on Earth. If you could bring the moon or a cosmic object, a planetary object, the same size, dimensions, etc. as our moon, in close to Earth, do you know what would happen? It would leach a little bit of the atmosphere from Earth, but the absolute majority of it would stay and remain around Earth. And that's because the surface gravity of this new object is less than that of Earth. I'm talking about the gravitational force, the gravitational attraction at the surface of the object. Now let's go in the opposite direction and take an object that is twice as big as Earth. As I said before, your surface gravity will not be twice as much, but it will be more. Now take your magic cosmic hand and move this larger object in close to Earth till all of a sudden the atmosphere of Earth gets in the proximity of this object, and you know what's going to happen? It's going to be a very short process for this object to drain the entire atmosphere of Earth off onto it, and the atmosphere of Earth would then surround this object simply because the surface gravity of this larger object is greater than that of Earth. Now, I want to talk about a scenario that happened a couple thousand years ago, and I don't put dates on these incidents. I don't have an exact date, but I'm going to talk about the Velikovsky scenario, where a large comet that eventually became the planet Venus came roaring through our solar system, and just it turns out that Venus, as we know it today, the planetary core, the nucleus of, or the planetary object that is in the center of that great atmosphere on Venus, that planetary core is larger than the core of Mars, but smaller than the core of Earth. So, guess what would happen if that object were to pass near Mars? And of course, now, in the full real scenario, that object, Venus the comet, would have a massive cometary coma and tail. It would have electrical discharges going on. It would have the planet, of course, if Mars came in close in a close encounter with this object, they would be in close proximity. And this is what would happen as a large comet would work its way into the inner solar system if that comet were captured into a stable orbit or an Earth-crossing orbit or a Mars-crossing orbit, as was the case with Venus. This is exactly what the ancients portray. Now, as I said, the core object in Venus is larger than that of Mars. So if it came near Mars, there would be an electrical connection that occurred, a scarring on the surface of Mars, possibly creating the three volcanoes we see in a row. That is one of the very likely candidates, as we see, for example, the recent pictures of the planet Mercury. Many surface scars due to electrical discharges. And I'd like to note that the first planetary or interplanetary electrical discharge marks I discovered and published in my papers in the early 1980s, and of course many have been observed since then. But back to the gravity scenario, because gravity is very important and many times left out of the analysis of what goes on in outer space. So if this object that were the size of Venus, that's the core nucleus of this comet, if that object were to pass by Mars, it would relieve Mars of its atmosphere in very short order. And if Mars had oceans similar to those of Earth, those would evaporate off and basically leave the planet Mars because there would be no atmospheric pressure to hold it in place. This is exactly what the ancients described. They described Mars as being a blue planet, just like Earth, oceans, water oceans. And guess what? As NASA goes up with landers and probes looking into the surface of Mars, guess what they're finding? A few inches under the surface, seawater. Isn't that interesting? So where did all the water go? Where did the atmosphere of Mars go? It was taken off of Mars by a large passing comet. Now, what would happen if that same cometary nucleus, about the size of Venus, then worked its way into the inner solar system and eventually came in close proximity to Earth? Earth has a much larger core, or planetary core. The surface gravity of Earth is larger, and therefore Earth would win the tug of war over the tail and atmosphere that was around this cometary surface, causing a tremendous influx of water, hydrocarbons, and of course the barrage of rocky material that is in the comet tail, the meteorite stream that typically follows a comet as part of the entourage of small particles, medium-sized particles, and even in many cases very large particles. So Earth would have been pummeled by a tremendous rocky barrage. Influx and pollution event would have been tremendous. The majority of that influx would have been in the form of water, H2O. And we see that our ocean today is about 600 feet above what it was many thousands of years ago. I just read today, again, I was reading, in fact, in the same article I read earlier about water, there was a statement that the Earth today has the exact same amount of water as when the dinosaurs lived, and when the exact same amount of water as when the Earth originally formed. That is absolutely false. Earth has had many events in its history, some where Earth lost atmosphere and ocean, some where it gained due to the size of the passing objects. So there are many of these objects in outer space, large celestial objects, and of course the one that passed by Earth eventually nestled into the orbit that we now see, the planet Venus. And why does this not make sense with mainstream astronomers? Because they think comets are dirty snowballs and melt and go away, when in fact they are growing, they are building up material, And this is done by electrical forces that are caused by the basically the plasma discharge comet model, which I describe in my books and have talked about many times on this radio show and in my original papers going back to the 1970s. It's a very subtle process. It's a very subtle process combining electrical conditions, gravitational conditions, and it is based on knowledge of how the solar wind works, the differential solar wind that has more protons. It's a very complex system, and every now and then I try and break out one of these very complex processes and describe it. So tonight I wanted to concentrate on how an object passing through the solar system, and Venus was the absolute most likely candidate for this operation. In fact, the ancients identify Venus specifically as the object that did the damage, that came by Earth, that came by Mars, relieved Mars of its atmosphere, but gave Earth a tremendous pollution event. Now, let's look at some other things that would happen as this cometary object came by Earth. Back to the gravitational field of the cometary object, of the comet soon to become planet Venus, which is not as big as Earth, but still a fairly significant planetary object. The best way to understand this is just looking at our very own moon. Every day, our Earth turns underneath the moon, and we all know about the tides in the ocean. The ocean rises up as the moon is up over the ocean, and then as the Earth continues to spin, the tide follows the moon, so to speak. And the moon is in orbit around Earth, of course, but basically the Earth is turning once every 24 hours on its axis. As it does, the oceans rise up and drop down, thusly causing the tides. And there's a small effect due to the sun, but the major portion of our tides, the major portion is due to the lunar interaction, the interaction of our moon. Now imagine an object coming by, or let's just imagine one more scenario. The Earth turns every 24 hours on its axis. So at the equator, since it's around 25,000 miles in diameter, the equator is literally moving at about 1,000 miles per hour. So the tide also, as it moves around the globe, is moving at about 1,000 miles per hour. That's quite fast, 1,000 mile per hour tide, and most people don't realize that. They think of the tide coming in very slowly and moving out very slowly. But the reality is that the tide is moving at about 1,000 miles an hour. Imagine an object the size of Venus coming by and inducing much greater tidal waves in the ocean and in the land. Now you start to see tidal waves of land rolling around the Earth, and probably at a velocity that's 2 to 3 times 1,000 miles an hour. It would cross the United States in a matter of a couple hours. This is what would cause mountain building, tremendous amounts of energy, gravitational energy, entering planet Earth's surface. And I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.